From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the partial government shutdown hits research into the Great Lakes.
Everybody at our laboratory feels privileged to work on the Great Lakes, and we all love them like all Michiganders do. And so we find it just really frustrating to not be able to be there doing what we love to do.
Why the three-year Flint water probe has frustrated one of its investigators.
We know that there's a lot of other folks in government, much higher up, who were involved in the Flint water crisis, and the public wants to see them held accountable.
MSU alum Jonathan Kirkland looks back at his 2 years playing George Washington in the Chicago company of Hamilton.
If there were any way to come full circle to where America should be, it would be a man of color playing a slave owner, but playing it my way.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just where do the investigations into the Flint water crisis currently stand?
We know what happened in Flint. What I wanted to learn with my civil investigation is how could this happen?
Noah Hall is a Wayne State University law professor, and he served as Special Assistant Attorney General investigating the Flint water crisis. As the new Attorney General Dana Nessel reevaluates her office's approach to this crisis, Hall offers us his first public thoughts on how the investigation has been going. That's later in the hour. But first, the partial government shutdown has moved into its third week, now one of the longest in history, as President Trump and congressional Democrats continue their standoff over funding the border wall. On Sunday, the president again said he might declare a national emergency to secure funds for a border wall and bypass Congress. Meanwhile, 800,000 employees, federal employees, are caught in the middle of this standoff, including biologist Dave Fanslow. He's president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 3908, representing the workers at NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor. Dave, tell us just what your lab does for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Well, Cynthia, our lab has two main functions, and one of them is to monitor the ecology and the food web in the Great Lakes, and the other is physical science, such as meteorology and lake levels.
So very important work for us having a sense on how the Great Lakes are doing.
That's right. We're kind of the key federal agency that's at the center of most of the Great Lakes research.
And how has this partial shutdown affected your lab?
Well, it's affected our lab in a few key ways. This time of year is when we should be collecting data on the way the lakes interact with the atmosphere in terms of the lake effect snow potential and forecasting lake effect snow. It's also impacting the ice forecasting. Our laboratory is the only source for current ice data and ice forecasting, and the shipping industry is an active user of that information, as you can imagine.
So when you think of what is not being done right now because of the partial shutdown, what might that be? What are we losing? What are we missing out on?
Well, we're missing out on a lot of data that helps to strengthen forecasting models for meteorology, so that can't really be replaced because the supercomputing that it takes to process that data is turned off. And so that's always a bottleneck in terms of doing models, is the availability of supercomputing resources. And that's off. And then another thing that we're losing right now, for example, would be circulation modeling, which also relies on the same supercomputing resources. So take, for example, the Straits of Mackinac and the Line 5 situation. If a oil spill were to occur right now while we're furloughed, we would not be able to provide up-to-date circulation information about what's going on with the movement of the waters there in the Straits of Mackinac.
So is the entire office furloughed? Is it shut down?
It's shut down. There's one person who's a facility manager who's coming in just to make sure that the building is staying safe and secure, and that's it.
When is the last time you and your coworkers were paid?
We were paid last week, and that was for work performed in the second and third weeks of December. And we are not going to get paid on our next scheduled date. So we do have a lot of members in our union who are, you know, starting to anticipate financial duress from this situation. We have people who are taking care of extended families and are the, you know, sole breadwinners.
And there probably is really, you know, when you ask how do you prepare for this, is there even a way to prepare for, say, having paychecks stop?
Well, you know, everybody has to deal with that. And so people make decisions about how much of a cushion to have. And when you work for the federal government, you know, people do tend to think it should be a fairly secure job. And so it's a unfortunate thing to be caught in the middle of a political situation when we feel like what we do is critically important to Michigan, to the Great Lakes. Everybody at our laboratory feels privileged to work on the Great Lakes, and we all love them like all Michiganders do. And so we find it just really frustrating to not be able to be there doing what we love to do.
In the meantime, our president says this shutdown could last months, even years, and he says he believes government workers would encourage him to keep going. Those are his words, with the shutdown, because a border wall is, again, his words, far more important than a fully operational government. And he says he can relate to your dilemma. How do you respond to that?
I'm not going to talk politics with the president about border walls, but the Great Lakes needs to be protected. The science needs to happen. And I don't understand why he feels it's necessary to hold the one thing hostage for the other.
In fact, when you stop and you kind of look at the effects of this partial shutdown, it has landed pretty squarely on all these agencies responsible for the government's response to climate change. So NOAA, the EPA, NASA.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Cynthia. You could think that perhaps there is a targeted, attack on science here. Right now, this week in Phoenix is the American Meteorological Society meeting. And it's a very important meeting where our Great Lakes researchers who do create these experimental models to improve lake snow forecasting, for example, where they would meet with their National Weather Service colleagues and other academic folks and, make plans for the next latest and greatest weather models so that we have better weather forecasting and improve our weather performance or our predictive performance.
I can hear you've got things going, really pots bubbling on two burners, certainly the personal financial concerns and also your caring about the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and so everybody is, stressed out, and, our union will rally, and if we have people in financial difficulty, we'll chip in and try to help out. For example, we have one person right now who's supposed to be onboarding today. Today was going to be their first day as a federal employee, and she quit her previous job and moved her family up to Ann Arbor. And, it's fairly high cost of living in Ann Arbor. So she's laying out a bunch of money to get situated. And now she will not get any compensation for sure for this period because she's not onboarded yet as a federal employee. So she's really caught in limbo. That's one example. You know, we have lots of others of personal impacts.
What would you say, if you could, to Congress and to the president?
I would say to fund the critical infrastructure of our country and deal with these other political fights separate. It's shortchanging our citizens, and everybody loses from this kind of shutdown.
Biologist Dave Fanslow is with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, and he's president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 3908. Dave, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Cynthia.
The U.S. Coast Guard is also affected by the partial shutdown because its budget is covered by the Department of Homeland Security and not the Department of Defense. And amidst fears this partial shutdown could last for weeks, GOP Senator John Thune of South Dakota has introduced the Pay Our Coast Guard Act to keep paychecks coming, even if appropriations stop. Three Republican and four Democratic senators have signed on as co-sponsors. With us now, Petty Officer Brian McCrum with the Coast Guard's 9th District. And this is a big area you cover. We're talking about all the Great Lakes and eight surrounding states.
Yep, that's correct.
So how have the 3,000 personnel from active duty to reserve to civilian, how have you all been impacted by the partial shutdown?
Well, for all of us on active duty, the active duty uniformed members are still reporting to work 100%. It's kind of the same for us. The only people who are not working during this time are our civilian personnel.
And are you getting paid? Have you been paid so far?
We were paid on the, we're normally paid on the 1st and the 15th. So we got our paycheck from this last, on the 1st. We actually got it on the 31st. So the next paycheck will be the 15th. So as of right now, we are not, you know, behind on any paychecks. It just depends on how long the shutdown lasts. And, so a paycheck is not guaranteed for the 15th.
Okay. And I'm got to imagine people are kind of keeping a very wary eye on what happens between now and the 15th.
Yeah, we're just focusing on our main essential missions. So search and rescue, port and homeland safety and security, anything that involves protection of life, property. So as far as us active duty, it's kind of ops normal until, you know, the longer the shutdown goes, the harder it would be to continue at full, you know, mission readiness. But as of now, we are, you know, like I said, we're just continuing our work.
So when we talk about operations in the 9th District during this partial shutdown, what has been curtailed?
So certain activities like recreational boarding, safety checks, fisheries enforcement patrols, routine maintenance, certain aids of navigation, or just administrative functions. So kind of, like I said, we are focusing on those main missions that are, you know, search and rescue, ice breaking operations on the Great Lakes, protection of life and property, stuff like that, environmental response, any hazardous material response.
As you say, those essential operations continue.
Correct, yes.
What do you want people on the waters of the Great Lakes to know?
Just that there has been a misconception with some people thinking that the Coast Guard's not working or whatever. We're still there 100% for active duty. So the majority of our workforce is still there protecting you and available for all those main missions, like I said, search and rescue, protection of life, property, all that.
Petty Officer Brian McCrum with the 9th District of the U.S. Coast Guard covering the Great Lakes and 8 surrounding states. Thanks for speaking with us on Stateside.
Yep, no problem. Thank you.
Coming up, for 2 years, Southfield native and MSU grad Jonathan Kirkland played George Washington in the Chicago production of the hit musical Hamilton. We'll talk with him about what it means to be an African-American playing the father of our country.
Representation and being seen is so vital, you know, especially in a world where entertainment, in large part, runs America.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been nearly 4 years now since Hamilton opened off-Broadway. Lin-Manuel Miranda's take on the life of the $10 founding father without a father exploded, and the hip-hop sung-through musical soon moved to Broadway. In September 2016, Hamilton opened in Chicago, where it has packed the house 8 shows a week ever since. One of the original members of that Chicago cast is here with us today. Jonathan Kirkland grew up in Southfield and then went on to Michigan State University, where he studied voice and opera and classical music, earning a Bachelor of Musical Performance degree. Last September, Kirkland retired from the Chicago company of Hamilton after 2 years of playing George Washington. I started out our conversation asking him if it's true that before he landed on a career in music and singing, he'd been eyeing a spot on MSU's basketball team.
Yes and no. That's a story that I think has been embellished through the years, and maybe some of that is my fault. but the truth is this: I've you know, my father was a basketball coach, and my brothers and I have always been either athletics or something in the artistic realm, you know. And for me, the feeling was, you know, if I really pursue playing ball, I think I have a shot to maybe do some things. So fast forward to Michigan State, and I get to college, and I go to the walk-on tryout. And it was good. I thought I played really well. But then I had the privilege of seeing Shannon Brown, Maurice Ager, Drew Neitzel, and all these guys up close and personal. I said, well, the truth is I'm not that. That's what NBA looks like. I'm not that guy.
Okay.
So I better stick with this singing thing and and ride that out and see where that goes. I mean, these guys were jumping out of the gym. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is crazy. Like, I'll never be that. As good as I thought I was, a good shooter and fundamentally and all that, the truth is, for my skill set, I would have had to be 5 inches taller. You know what I mean? And much more athletic.
There are schools that get the lion's share of attention as top places for studying and training in the performing arts. I'm thinking of NYU, University of North Carolina School for the Arts, Wesleyan, where Lin-Manuel Miranda went, U of M, Juilliard. You chose Michigan State. Why?
It felt like home. As a kid who didn't know much about, I was very honest about, I don't know if I'm going to stick with this, you know, opera, while I saw my mother and her career and how successful she was. The truth is, opera wasn't popular. You know what I mean? Classic music wasn't the most popular vein to go into. So for me, I didn't know if it'd be something I'd fall in love with, if it'd be something I wanted to stick with. But I knew I was talented and I knew I was gifted. And vocally, it's still to this day my best vocal quality, if you will. So the conversation was always, well, where will I end up? That'll be a place where I feel like I'm nurtured and where I feel like they'll care about me. And at MSU, that conversation was always very clear. Professor Fracker, who was my voice coach, said day one at my audition, like I sang for everyone and they, you know, they liked my stuff. And then he and I worked together for a little while in his studio. And he said, Jonathan, listen, you know, if you choose to stick with this or not, it's up to you. We just want to help you achieve your dreams and get to where you want to go. And if it's opera, great. We'd love that. If not, then we'll help you figure something else out, you know? And at that moment, it was really clear, like, this is where I feel as though I need to be.
And what did the training that you got at MSU, how did that prepare you for that day-in, day-out challenge of being a professional actor and singer?
So I take that deep breath because it was rigorous, man. I mean, rehearsals all the time, which is a good problem to have. Like, that means you're actually performing and you're actually doing work. As much as I love basketball, last night when my family and I went to watch Michigan State play Northwestern, that was the first basketball game I saw at the Breslin Center. And I was on campus for 5 years, right?
Wow.
So the thing was, is during basketball season, that's opera season. So we're in rehearsals and we're doing shows and we have things to prepare. So I couldn't be a part of that as much as I wanted to, or all the parties you want to enjoy in college or whatever. But I got to rest my voice because I got to sing the next day, you know? So a lot of that, it taught the sacrifice of what it takes to be an artist. Many people say to be an artist is a blue collar job. And in many ways, I agree with that. If nothing else, it's very hard work and it's very rigorous work. And MSU taught us how rigorous it is from a class schedule perspective, a rehearsal perspective, and then actually having to perform, you know?
So you took that skill set, and even though you'd been doing opera, you made this jump over to musical theater. How did that happen?
So I went to the University of Houston for grad school, and my opera director was Buck Ross. And we would have these unspoken conversations about where we assumed I would end up. And he would just kind of say, like, Jonathan, just don't be surprised if you make a switch. You know what I mean? Like, if time goes on, I just see you moving to New York and you might make a switch. I was like, all right, well, we'll see. And the first musical theater production I did was in Houston at a theater called the Ensemble Theater. And they did a Cinderella. And it wasn't Rodgers and Hammerstein. It was an original take on Cinderella adapted by the African-American Shakespeare Festival with this original, like, R&B and soul music and all this stuff. And it blew my mind. And I got to play Prince Charming. It took me to a different level that I didn't know existed for me.
It opened that door.
It opened the door. Yeah. And after that show, you know, my wife and I think we were engaged at the time. And I just said, I think we got to move to New York. I think I got to go for it, man. I think this musical theater side is more artistically, I just think is something that I'm enamored by and I want to give it a shot, you know. And at the time, operatically, my voice was still growing and is still growing. And oftentimes for male singers, baritones, it takes some time to kind of to let your roots settle operatically. So I figured, well, if I move to New York, I can leverage my voice and earn work in the theater world, you know, and grow as an actor in this other realm that I really want to pursue while my voice settles operatically if I choose to go back that route.
So you were keeping options open. How long until you landed Hamilton?
We moved to New York in June of 2013, and I started rehearsal for Hamilton in August of 2016. So 3 years. Okay. 3 years. I taught for the first year in New York, went full-time in the summer of 2014, and 2 years later was, you know, playing George Washington. They were crazy enough to give me a shot. So.
And when I think of these years since Hamilton opened off Broadway, now we are familiar with seeing actors of color playing the founding fathers and mothers. Yeah. It was so novel when it first opened. What do you feel? You've been in that Hamilton bubble for those 2 years you played George Washington. What does it mean for young people in color in terms of opening eyes and ears first to musical theater and also to that even as a career?
I think it's huge. I think representation and being seen is so vital, you know, especially in a world where entertainment in large part runs America. You know what I mean? In many ways, like what we see even if you look at social media, it's entertaining. That's why we go to it, looking at people's pictures, looking at their little videos or whatever. And on the tragic side, seeing how people of color can be treated, you know, be it police officers, be it school, be it whatever the case may be. But it's all something that we visualize that shifts and scopes how we view ourselves and how we view the world, right? And I think for young kids, my goal has always been, you'll see something in me that resonates with you to say, well, this guy followed a dream and he actually did it. You know, the saying is art goes in line and in stream with culture, right? I've always believed that art can shift and dictate culture. I believe that. I believe what we see shapes how we feel and what we believe. And seeing actors of color play founding fathers hopefully will take a step forward in leading the country in a way to get us to be a little more colorblind, which is what we actually say we want to be on paper. So hopefully it brings America closer to what we say we actually strive to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. As you played George Washington, what did that mean for you personally to be standing there being the father of our country?
It was interesting. It was an honor. But it was also this intriguing duality of an internal debate, right? Like, I'm playing a guy that owned slaves, and I'm playing a guy who was courageous enough to fight a war he knew he couldn't win but found a way to win, to be the president of the nation when he wanted to retire, all these different things that Washington did but didn't have the courage to fight to free slavery when he knew it was wrong. To have so much courage to do these things in real life, but then this cowardice when it came to the lives of other humans who actually built the nation. You know what I mean? So it was an honor, but at the same time, in moments, there was this really, I don't want to go as far as to say struggle, but at times an internal debate of, you know, is this the right role? Is this something, should I do this? But then what always brought me back really quickly to I need to do this and I should is because if there were any way to come full circle to where America should be, it would be a man of color playing a slave owner, but playing it my way, doing it with my interpretation as a black actor, with my urban colloquialism swag, know what I mean?
Yes.
Doing it my way with my flavor, with my acting chops, and telling your story the way I decide to tell it. And I would hope that's something that, you know, if he's in his grave, hopefully he wouldn't be rolling around, but would be proud, I would hope. And if not, I'm fine with that too. You know what I mean?
What lines resonated most with you as you would sing them?
A lot of them, man. So with the show, it's taken different tones based on what's happened in our nation. The show we did before the election, the night before the election, was completely different than the show we did the day after the election. So certain words that had meaning day one had a little less, and then other words had a little more meaning day two. For example, right-hand man is, you know, this powerful, we're at war, it's an explosive scene. And the words in Right Hand Man never really initially, it was just always dope. It was like, man, Lin can write. This is a dope rap. But being the thought of being outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned, for certain people in this country, you know, when our president was elected, that's how we began to feel a little bit. You know what I mean? So day one, what was just a really cool rap kind of turned into, this is how I feel. So to not be on such a tragic side, other words that consistently had a more positive meaning was Washington's "I want to sit under my own vine and fig tree." That because as John Kirkland, I'm so focused on legacy, and everything I do is in trying to leave an inheritance for my children's children and making sure my family is taken care of and all those kind of old school values.
Safe in this country we've made.
Know what I mean? You want to be safe in this nation that we've made and wanting to do everything I can to build that. So that part of the song musically is already so emotional, but you throw in who you are as a person. If you throw yourself into the work as an actor, then it can be it was always really tough to kind of get through that one. And really, as I'm thinking, all of Washington stuff, history having its eyes on you is such a big deal. So much of what my character in the show said and sung resonates. And it hit me in a spot because in many ways, Washington, take away the slavery part, in many ways, as I studied him, he and I have very similar traits. He was a family man. He was a sensitive man. But when it came time for battle, he was ready to go. We kind of lined up, you know? So in a lot of his words, it wasn't hard for me to, if you will, find the character because this dude in many ways is, I feel like, is me, you know?
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jonathan Kirkland, the Southfield native and MSU grad who spent 2 years as George Washington in the Chicago Company of Hamilton. And Jonathan, I'm really interested in that view from inside the Hamilton bubble as a cast member. What struck you most about the way that audiences would respond to what you were doing on that stage?
The thing that was crazy was there would be 8-year-old African-American boys and 80-year-old Jewish women who were enamored with this show. And it would blow my mind. Like, we would go out and, you know, speak to the audience and maybe sign autographs. And I would see these little kids of color and they would say, man, that was dope. Man, that was great. That was amazing. And then these old, sweet little Jewish women say, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. So I'm like, this is, how did Lynn write a show that's palatable for everyone in a nation that can't really agree on much, but somehow has found a way to agree that, well, this show we all like for the most part.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's the fusion of hip-hop, you know, with the hip-hop undertone, and then the fact that it's a musical theater show with a hip-hop undertone but with amazing songs and amazing music. We as Americans, if we don't appreciate anything else, we like good music, right?
We do.
So I think the fact that he wrote music and it's American history, that's the biggest bit.
In all its messiness.
In all its messiness. Yes. It's a view, it's a look on American history through the scope, really, to me, of Aaron Burr, but that's a whole different conversation. Mm-hmm. But it's the view of American history through this guy's lens, and it gives you some of the mess, some of the glory, some of the confusion. So I think the fact that it's history really has people enamored, because anyone who's an adult comes back and says, I had no idea. I don't remember any of that. And I got an A in history.
Because it wasn't on those
pages. I don't remember any of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that's what has people enamored. But what was also really cool was, you know, we could see the first few rows of the audience, right? So it was also really, really cool to, you know, see one of my colleagues just killing a scene. And if I look in the audience really quick, just watching how engaged, I would say 9 out of 10 people really were. Now, we have a saying, our director, Tommy Kale, always had a saying that said, look, every show you're going to change a life, and every show someone's going to take a nap. That just is what it is. You know what I mean? It can be the best show in the world and someone's going to take a nap, but someone's life will be changed in every way. Someone will turn 180 once they walk out of that theater and do something they never thought they could do, or at least try it, you know?
What are the personal challenges of 8 shows a week?
Oh, my God. So from a voice perspective, I'm, I guess, what the opera world would call a lyric baritone, what the theater world would call a baritenor, right? Long story short, I'm at the top of my range with Hamilton, right? Like, I'm up about as high as I go, you know? So for me, it was a lot of vocal rest. It was a lot of learning how to take care of your body, learning how to take care of your instrument. Then my wife and I were blessed enough to have our daughter, so entering the new challenge of being a father. So it's like, man, how do you balance all these different things while actually showing up to perform this show with the energy and the gravitas that I try to bring to it night in and night out. So it's very athletic. You know, being an actor in any realm, I think, is very athletic, but especially musical theater, because you're pouring out so much and you're giving out so much. You know, I had done shows where I had done 6 shows a week, you know, maybe 7 shows a week, but I wasn't playing George Washington. Mm-hmm. You know, even if I was playing a lead, it wasn't George Washington. So
with all the gravitas that demands.
Right.
Yeah, magnificent
role.
Yeah, it's
amazing. So the challenge was learning how to balance that, learning how to take care of your voice, because the truth is the next audience deserves the same performance, if not better, than the audience before. If you can't give 100% of what you have, you shouldn't be out there that night.
I saw, in fact, it's on your Instagram page, a video of your final curtain call when you left the show this past September. You knelt down and kissed the stage.
I did.
What was going on in your mind and heart at that moment?
You know, for me, Hamilton was in many ways answered prayers, right? Like, in a lot of ways, it was, you know, as an actor, you don't know if you can tackle certain roles until you tackle it. You can be as confident as you want to be, but until that challenge comes, you don't know if it's something that you can actually do. And for me, you know, booking the show and being a part of that company for 2 years was just, it was life changing. And it was so many confirmations for my career, so many confirmations personally, you know. So at that moment, it was just thinking back on day one at rehearsal and how excited I was, but how nervous I was, because now, I mean, there were people in that room that I have looked up to and admired for years, and now we're colleagues, and now we're going to lunch, and now we're talking art and acting and things like that.
I'm part of this? They
right?
let me in?
Like, they actually, they really did that. So, you know, Lin is in the corner on his computer typing away, probably writing Moana or whatever he's doing. I don't know. Whatever Lin does, right? And then, you know, I'm looking at Josh Henry, a guy that I've admired for so long, and Wallace Smith and Karen Olivo and these people that I'm like, man, I've looked up to y'all and y'all don't even know. And now I'm in a room with you guys. You know what I mean? And then at the end of the day, I think how proud of myself that I was. You know, we don't take enough time to be proud of ourselves when we achieve goals. We can do it, and then we get so caught on the next thing, especially in our millennial generation. So I was proud that for 2 years I gave everything I had every night, point blank period. And I was just proud of myself, and I was grateful to God that I was blessed enough to have the opportunity to be a part of one of the greatest shows in world history, you know. So, and also a Spartan, I guess, kissing the floor is a traditional thing that we do. But at the time, I wasn't even really thinking about that. But maybe that's that Spartan blood that runs in me, because I really wasn't even considering that. It was just something, it's just in the moment, you know what I mean? Because this floor was my home for 2 years. And now it's time for me to leave and elevate and go on to the next thing.
So what is the next thing? What's next? What do you have your eye on?
Well, I can't share it yet, but we do have some irons in the fire and some really good things that I'm hoping to announce pretty soon. But we got to wait and see. I'm waiting to get some final words. And as soon as I get them, I'll let everyone know. So just be on the lookout. Be on the lookout. But I can't share it yet. Like, all right. Per like contractual stuff.
Absolutely.
I can't say anything yet.
Yeah. But things are shaping up.
Things are shaping. Things are working, man. Things are working. I can't complain.
Very good. Jonathan Kirkland, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
And you can find a full, longer conversation with John Kirkland by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Up next, a candid assessment of where the years-long investigation into the Flint water crisis now stands. That's next on Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In January 2016, then State Attorney General Bill Schuette announced he would investigate the Flint water crisis. Ultimately, criminal charges were brought against 15 current or former state and city officials, charges ranging from felonies to misdemeanors. Wayne State University law professor Noah Hall is an expert on environmental and water law, and he's been part of the investigation, serving as Special Assistant Attorney General. Well, now Bill Schuette is no longer the AG. Democrat Dana Nessel is in charge, and Noah Hall wants to talk about these past 3 years. What's worked, what hasn't, and why. Noah Hall, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into details, just give me your short answer on how you think the investigation has gone after 3 years. How would you characterize it?
It's been frustrating. First of all, let's start with the reality that a lot of folks in Flint still don't have clean water while this investigation has been going on. And so as frustrating as it is that the investigation is taking several years and legal accountability is going to take even more, there's a tremendous weight looming over all of that, which is while we're continuing to fight for the citizens of Flint and trying to hold government officials accountable, a lot of folks in Flint are still struggling every day to meet their life needs with basic clean water.
So as of last week, you no longer report to Bill Schuette, and now you feel you're able to speak about the Flint investigation in a way that you could not have up until now, both the criminal and the civil sides. Why is that?
Well, to be very clear, working with Bill Schuette, I always found him to have tremendous integrity and the highest of legal ethics. He made the decision early on when he announced his Flint water crisis investigation that he was going to take the unusual step of directly involving himself in this investigation and in the work of the special counsel. Now, what's very unusual about this is that the Attorney General for the state of Michigan has a constitutional duty to defend the state and its officers, including the governor and the agency officials. So the Attorney General is constitutionally obligated to defend the state, but the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, wanted to be involved in the investigation of the governor's administration and other wrongdoing by state officials. This created at least the appearance of a conflict, and it came to a head about 2 years ago when we filed some papers in a federal court, and a federal judge made very clear that as long as Bill Schuette individually was involved in the special counsel's civil litigation work, we could not take positions against the state of Michigan. Now that Bill Schuette is no longer in office and Dana Nessel is the attorney general, Dana Nessel has not had any interference or communication with my civil litigation work. And my assumption is that she's allowing the civil litigation to continue. I intend to wrap up the work shortly and provide a complete report and accounting to the public of what happened, why it happened, and most importantly, how we can fix state government so that what happened in Flint will not happen over and over again.
Okay, let's start, if we can, with the criminal charges. 3 years, 15 people charged, including Health and Human Services Director Nick Lyon and Dr. Eden Wells, the state's medical executive. In fact, preliminary hearings are scheduled to continue today. No one has gone to trial, much less no convictions. So you've got two Michigan Department of Environmental Quality officials have pleaded no contest to misdemeanors, and they're agreeing to testify against other officials in their criminal cases. So there we are. What are you satisfied with, Noah, in terms of who has been charged criminally and what those charges are?
Well, without speaking to the culpability of any of the individual defendants, all of whom have constitutional rights, I will say that I feel very solid about charging the officials that we did. Subsequent civil litigation, including a recent decision just last week out of the Federal Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, looked at a lot of the same facts, many of the same documents, emails, pieces of evidence about the wrongdoing committed by these officials, and reached very strong conclusions that what went on in Flint was not a mistake. It was not an accident, and it was not the result of somebody being negligent on the job. Instead, what happened in Flint was the direct, predictable, intended result of unconscionable actions by state officials to disregard the law, disregard physical evidence of harm to individuals, and then lie and cover up what they did.
And this is, as you say, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals says this.
Right. Now, this is in the context of civil litigation,
yes,
and
yes,
these defendants are very much entitled to their day in court on criminal charges. But to be clear, these are not folks just doing their job. These were folks who took affirmative actions that resulted in tremendous harm and even loss of life in Flint. Now, the frustrating reality is that of those 15 officials charged, I think it's fair to say that all of them are the types of officials who were involved in carrying out orders and decisions for the Flint water crisis, covering up wrongdoing, sometimes lying and falsifying documents to cover up the wrongdoing. But these officials don't seem to be the power brokers, the real decision makers, the folks who not just put lives at risk at Flint, but benefited from those decisions. And what's frustrating both for the lawyers involved and certainly for the people in Flint is that for the 15 officials that we have charged, we know that there's a lot of other folks in government much higher up who were involved in the Flint water crisis, and the public wants to see them held accountable.
Yeah. So before we dig into that, I want to ask you about the civil investigation, which you've been very involved with. What is it you were looking to find out and the questions you wanted to answer for the people of Flint?
Well, when we began the civil investigation, at first we just wanted to find out what happened. It turns out what happened in Flint is actually fairly straightforward. The work here at Michigan Radio by other journalists and as well as the Flint Water Task Force very clearly laid that out early in 2016. We know what happened in Flint. What I wanted to learn with my civil investigation is how could this happen? How could it go on for 2 years? And what are we going to do to fix the structural problems that allowed this to happen? What happened in Flint was not a one-time mistake or even the result of specific actions by the officials, many of whom we've charged criminally. But what happened in Flint was the result of a systematic breakdown of our environmental laws, a failure of environmental protection in state government, and a loss of accountability to the public at all levels of government that we need to fix. The more we looked at what happened in Flint, the more we realized that it wasn't about lead or pipes or even water. It's about broken government.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Noah Hall, Wayne State University law professor, who's been serving on the Flint water investigation as Special Assistant Attorney General. So here's, I think, the question on so many minds. Why is it we still don't know, Noah, why there was such a hell-bent rush to get the Karenandi Water Authority going, to issue an administrative consent that let the city of Flint, which was already drowning in debt and under state emergency management, to issue bonds for this new KWA pipeline? Because wasn't that whole hell-bent rush to clear the path of the KWA, didn't that lead to all the awful decisions that we're very familiar with, using Flint River water, not treating it and running the untreated water through the Flint water treatment plant when it was by no means ready to do that? Why have we heard so little about the KWA and the new pipeline?
That's a great question. You're exactly right on the importance of the KWA pipeline. And the underlying financing for it in what led to the Flint water crisis. To be very blunt, the approval of those bonds and the issuance of those bonds for that KWA pipeline is loaded with fraud. And the frauds were committed by not just the attorneys working on behalf of the project. These are, you know, private corporate bond attorneys, but state officials at the Department of Environmental Quality, who issued an improper administrative consent order, and frankly, by the Attorney General's office itself. The Attorney General's office signed off on the administrative consent order, which allowed the underlying fraud to occur. The way I look at it now is that given that the Attorney General's office signed off on the administrative consent order, it made investigating the circumstances of that administrative consent order and its approval very difficult and challenging under the previous administration. Now I think we're free to go and investigate all aspects of wrongdoing in all branches of state government, including the signing of that administrative consent order by the Attorney General's office. And I appreciate that Attorney General Nessel is not attempting to interfere with our investigation of, I won't even say necessarily wrongdoing, but flaws in the process.
But you use the word fraud.
Yeah. Well, and that's because, to be very straightforward, the state of Michigan committed a fraud in indebting the city of Flint for bonds for a project that it was never going to see. Folks in Flint are going to be paying debt on bonds that an emergency manager saddled them with thanks to the involvement of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the State Attorney General's office. We need to get to the bottom of this. We need to see how this happened. We need to see why the Attorney General's office did not provide independent oversight of the Department of Environmental Quality in issuing the administrative consent order, and we need to ensure that far better accountability is put in place in the future so that this type of fraud doesn't happen again.
And you talked earlier, as you're saying, you know, we've got these 15 officials, but we don't know who the power brokers are, which leads me to ask, as you've been investigating and digging, who do you think are the power brokers who were so, you know, hitting the accelerator pedal to get a KWA? You know, the people in Flint weren't asking for it.
No. You know, the KWA had been bouncing around as an idea since about 2008, 2009, and really didn't get any traction in Lansing. It was essentially a pipeline without customers, without money. Nobody needed it and nobody wanted it. And then come 2013, 2014, all of a sudden the Snyder administration was very interested in moving the KWA pipeline forward.
Do we know why?
Well, here's what I can say. The KWA pipeline doesn't really benefit many folks. Nobody in Flint needs it. They already had a pipeline working just fine, bringing Lake Huron water to the city of Flint. We don't really know who the KWA pipeline helps, but we know who it hurts. The construction of the KWA pipeline and moving Flint to KWA pushed the Detroit Water Sewer District further into bankruptcy and all but sealed its fate in terms of financial solubility moving forward. By pulling Flint off of DWSD, Governor Snyder ensured that DWSD as a unit was going to fall apart, and it led, of course, to the restructuring and the reallocation of decision-making to the new Great Lakes Water Authority. It's a convoluted tale, but in a way it's pretty straightforward and simple. Folks in the United States going back to Hamilton and Burr have known that if you control the water, you control development, and then you control the economy. There's been ongoing fights in Michigan over control of regional water authorities and the resulting power you'd have for economic development. Unfortunately, the folks in Flint got caught right in the middle of the fight and were poisoned as a result.
Even as Bill Schuette campaigned for governor by pointing out his work in the Flint water investigation, people in Flint, Noah, were really quick to go, hey, hold on. We went to the attorney general in 2015. We were complaining of bad water, complaining of health problems, and nothing was done. Are those fair criticisms?
Those are very fair criticisms. And again, it's another reason that I'm optimistic starting this week and starting this year that we'll be able to complete our civil investigation. To be very clear, the wrongdoing that led to Flint occurred in all aspects of state government. The lead is on everyone's hands. The Attorney General's office ignored complaints about unsafe water in Flint, not just for 1 year, but really two or three. And more fundamentally, these weren't just citizen complaints. The Attorney General's office has independent constitutional authority to uphold the environmental laws of the state of Michigan. If the Department of Environmental Quality is the one breaking those laws, then it's more important than ever for the Attorney General to act independently and oversee the Department of Environmental Quality and initiate enforcement actions. None of that occurred. What the citizens desperately need right now as a first step is an objective, independent report about all of the failings in all aspects of state government. No more finger pointing, not one department saying it was another department's job, or the attorney general saying it was the governor's job, or the state saying it was the federal government's job. We need one report that shows the systematic failings, and more importantly, how are we going to fix this so that the next time a citizen is drinking, has concerns about her water, or more more frighteningly, the water that she's giving to her children, there's a number she can call with somebody who's going to respond to that complaint, investigate it, and ensure that ultimately the public health is protected. What we saw in Flint were hundreds of citizen complaints to the Attorney General's office and the US EPA about wrongdoing at the Department of Environmental Quality, and they were all ignored. We need a far better solution.
Noah, why has this investigation taken so long?
Investigating an administration while that administration holds many of the levers of power in state government is one of the more challenging things I've done as a lawyer.
And we reached out to a representative for former Attorney General Bill Schuette, offering him a chance to comment. We did not immediately hear back. Tomorrow, part two of our conversation with Noah Hall. We'll hear how Michigan's new Attorney General and new Democratic control of the House of Representatives could be game changers for this investigation. Plus, Hall will share his recommendations to ensure that a water crisis like Flint's never happens again in Michigan.
One of the very frightening lessons we've learned from the Flint water investigation is that what happened in Flint can happen anywhere, and in fact is happening in many other places.
And that's our show for today. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.